Code monkey, get up, get coffee. Code monkey, go to job. Code monkey, have boring meeting with boring manager Rob. Rob say code monkey, very diligent, but his output stink. His code not functional or elegant. What do code monkey think? Code monkey think.
Hello and welcome to From Python Import Podcast. I am Chris Miller and I am here with my co-hosts, Mike Crute and Dave Stanek. We need to apologize. This is extremely late, and the audio quality is not going to be what you're used to. The reason here, it's late because first we had the Memorial Day holiday, and honestly, me and my family, we're in the process of moving from one house to another house that we just bought. So my life has been crazy, and because of that, the recording equipment has been packed away, so we're doing this on a little H4 in a conference room that's not the best for sound. However, we hope you'll be able to listen and enjoy. Now, I know, Mike, you wanted to bring up the Mac Python port.
Yeah, just a moment of errata here.
Erotic what?
Not erotic. There's no C in there.
Oh, sorry.
E-R-R-A.
Sorry, I missed that. I'm sorry. Go on.
Anyhow, it's a hard problem. I apparently had mentioned that Python development on a Mac is kind of annoying, to which the Mac Python guys thought that was a mention to them. Unfortunately, it's not. We love the Mac Python guys, and I'm very sorry that Apple rips up your distribution before dumping it in their OS. But the problem there is that Apple tends to put libraries in very weird places and ultimately come up with a Python on Mac. It's difficult to figure out where you're importing things from, whether they came from system or library or your local library. So just wanted to apologize to the Python for Mac guys. Wasn't calling you guys out.
So the topic for today, I think this is one that Mr. Stanek brought up, so I'm going to let him do the introduction.
So I originally brought it up to these guys as I hate decorators, and that's not entirely true.
But it's provocative.
It's provocative. Not as provocative as my blog post title that I'm going to release soon. But the general idea is that they're being used all over the place for everything you can think of, and that's not necessarily the right thing to do. And it'd be nice if people understood the implications of doing that. And what does it mean to decorate your code?
Right. And that was going to be my first question, just to kind of bring it up so that people who may not be familiar can explain what a decorator is and how it's implemented in Python.
So a decorator is a nice fluffy syntax for something you could always do in Python, which is essentially wrap a method inside of another method so that you can perform some operation before or after that method.
Okay.
It's really simple as it is.
There's also a design pattern called decorator. They're kind of a different concept, aren't they?
In principle, they're the same. They try to decorate something, but the implementations are completely different. In the decorator that is the design pattern, typically you have an interface and you have implementations of that interface, and you basically wrap things together. So you can think of it as like WSGI middleware, where you're just wrapping something around something else, and eventually you have something that looks like the original interface, but there's just a call stack it goes through to get to the actual logic. Then you can perform operations at any level before or after the existing call. Mm-hmm. The way Python does it in the decorator syntax is different. It's just a wrapper around a particular function. And it's different because the thing I don't like about it is it limits the reuse of code because it's very static. Decorator pattern introduces some level of composability where you just at runtime you're assembling this call stack that you eventually call. With a decorator, you're actually telling on import time, this will always happen before or after. There's no way to recompose that. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're locking yourself. You're locking yourself in, effectively.
Yeah, you limit the code reuse because what if you need that same logic in that function or method, mm-hmm. and so you don't want that decorator for a particular case. Mm-hmm. Like, there's strategies for getting around that, like making sure that the method that's decorated is small and the real logic is somewhere else. But I'm just seeing a lot of code that doesn't really do that very well.
So do you have any examples?
Well, some of the things that I hate, mm-hmm. with a passion is the routing thing with decorators. Like, you I don't even know any of the libraries, so I don't use any of them, but you say like at URL and then slash, and then the actual function is the thing that gets called when you go to slash in the web browser. Mm. Or slash blog, you call the blog function. And you basically decorate each one of these functions to tell it, here's the route you're going to find it in.
I've seen people do that with, like, requires HTTPS and user authentication stuff, too.
Hate that as well. So, like, Django does it really nice for the routing part, where the routes are separate from the views.
Right.
Which allows you to compose your actual web project as a bunch of apps, and you can put them under different URLs, and it's very easy and nice. Django does... I don't know if you have to do this. I'm not as familiar with this part of Django, but Django has decorators where you could do the authorization type stuff. Say this is a protected view, mm-hmm. which I don't like, because what if in a different web app that same view is not protected anymore? You've automatically bound that to be protected.
But I kind of like decorators in that respect for some use cases. For example, I have a set of management scripts that I use that I want to run the main method many times depending on what applications are deployed on the box. The decorator itself is really just wrapping something in a for loop. But it's used only in a place where I import everything that I need to do. So it's just a main method where I'm trying to wire up a bunch of things and then call it many times.
Yeah,
what do you think of that?
And that's not necessarily bad. I mean, that goes into... So I have four reasons that people use decorators, and one of them is, there's probably more reasons, but the ones that I've seen that are obvious is one of them is code reuse. If you have the same bit of code, you can always put at the beginning of all these functions or at the end of all the functions. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that people like to do that is wrap it up in a decorator. And that example is code reuse, right? Where you have 10 main methods across 10 different binaries or 10 different crons that you're going to run, and they're all going to do the exact same thing at the beginning.
It still modifies the behavior of the function.
No, it does, but, I mean, I don't necessarily think that that's... I mean, I'm not against decorators in general. It's just that I think people need to understand the trade-offs that you have. Like, in that case, the trade-off of making it static so that you can't unbind it, you're probably never going to unbind a main. Main is always going to be the starting point of that particular job.
And, now, it doesn't really limit testability either. I think in a main method, main methods are inherently difficult, if not impossible to test anyhow. So as long as you're careful to keep all of your logic out of the main method in library code, it probably doesn't hurt you test-wise either.
Yeah, I don't think that use case is necessarily bad. But things that I really hate are like cache decorators. And I know we do that here a lot, where you assume that something's going to call this code. You want it to, the result to always be stored in memcache for any parameters. So if you pass in... If it's just a string parameter you pass in, for every mm-hmm. instance of a string that's passed in, you cache the value going back out. Mm-hmm. The problem is, though, that there's like an out-of-band thing that happens, right? This cache decorator needs to know where to store it.
Right.
So it uses config files or some other mechanism to get all that data. And it's very hard to test that stuff.
Well, it does look like magic after a while. I mean, new developers come in and go, oh, wow, this is great.
Cached.
Right,
done.
Exactly. Wrong.
So, I mean, I don't like... some of those cases like that where there's a lot of like out of band and you know magic going on.
That particular use case actually has hurt me before, where I threw a cache decorator on something not thinking about it, and the result of my function was about an 8 megs worth of data. That didn't play so nice with memcache. So
memcache just says, nope, I'm not going to cache it.
Yeah, which actually caused some really bad things to happen in my program.
Gee, I can't imagine why that would have been.
So, I mean, like, one of the other things is registration, and like I already talked about the URL mapper thing that a lot of those libraries do, and I talked about how Django does that in some of its things, and like how you register tags, you can do that with the decorator and other stuff. And I don't know that it's necessarily bad in all cases. Like in Django's tag case, as long as the logic isn't, you know, if it's reusable logic and it's not all in that tag method, mm-hmm. then it's probably okay. But there's a lot of cases where people are doing it for just all the wrong reasons, just because it's pretty and you can decorate stuff. And I learned a new trick today.
So how would you, I mean, your four items that you have there, you know, you felt like the first one was kind of pretty okay, you know, depending.
They're all okay depending. Right. That's right. The thing, is that you just have to understand the trade-offs that are happening.
Mm-hmm. I guess my question is, how would you do it differently?
It depends. So, like, one of the use cases is the cache, mm-hmm. right? I would not decorate methods in the cache. I would actually pass them into the class, pass a cache object of some sort into the class and make it use it.
Okay.
And then that way you can switch out the implementations. You know that, you know, there's no magic happening. It's really easy to test because you pass in a mock cache and you're done. Like the URL mapping, Django does a great job. It just has a whole separate way to map this view to this URL. There's much better patterns.
That's the way I've always used routing. I've never seen it done the other way, so I wasn't.
A lot of these newer, small, like single file libraries are doing stuff like that. I can't even think of an example.
Flask is one that does that. I'm not a fan.
Well, are they doing it because they're trying to remain one file, or are they doing it just because they can?
I think it's simplicity, and I think it's somewhat short-sighted. I think a lot of the people that maybe use that stuff don't make apps that, you know, stand the test of time or not reusable. It's not the same class of apps that I normally have to deal with, right?
Right, right. I mean, it might be good for smaller sites, but you wouldn't want to run something.
But someone might not realize that when they start into it and then realize that, oh, crap, I'm too far down the wrong path, and now I have to go and spend a month redoing everything.
So it really comes down to almost a responsibility on the part of programmers, you know, when you're building especially a framework, you know, really think hard about whether you want to be decorating things, because it seems to me that what that does is you run the danger of becoming, how can I put it? You run the danger of, well, just magic. I think magic is probably the better way to do it. It's kind of like when people use IDEs and they think that everything comes with tap completion. You know, you don't learn the libraries because everything can be tab completed. So I guess where I'm going with that is, you know, are you sure you want to be using decorators? Because the programmers that are going to be using your stuff won't know Python. They'll just know your brand of framework that happens to use Python.
Back in the Xena Python, I think that, think about it for a moment how would you do this in Java? A far more strict language than Python. But in a sense, that strictness gives you less to shoot yourself in the foot with.
That is a good point.
If you don't have decorators, you don't have decorators in Java, ignoring annotations, it's not quite the same thing, but you're forced to compose these things at runtime in methods, as opposed to just slapping a decorator on something and moving about your merry way.
The interesting thing there is that we had this conversation in the parking lot the other day. Is it because of how rigid and static Java's rules are, they actually make you make your application in a more dynamic way than Python forces you to? Because because of those rules, you would more likely use the decorator pattern, compose things in a way that you can recompose them and rework them on the fly. And in Python, you don't necessarily have to. People are like, okay, well, we're going to decorate this because it's a cool syntax.
Well, there we go. Java's better. Turn off this podcast.
Well, so what you're saying then is that Java's more dynamic than Python.
Java itself is not more dynamic, but I think it forces you in some cases, especially the good Java programmers, to be more dynamic. Right? It gives you the tools that are so rigid that you have to think about ways to make your app dynamic. Whereas Python makes anything possible, and so newbies come in, and even seasoned Python people come in and say, okay, well, I can do this very easily with a decorator. It's one line versus three lines. Go.
There's a joke we jab at all the new the Java guys that are converting over to Python is... The best way to make a good Java programmer, a great Java programmer, is to make him code Python for 2 years. I'm actually starting to think that maybe the opposite is also true. It forces you to think about design in a completely different way.
You know, it's funny. I'm programming right now in both Python and Java, you know, kind of going back and forth between the two. And I can definitely see that the two have an interesting complement to one another. This might be a good topic for a future show where we bring on some of the Java heads from our departments. But I do find that one definitely informs the other. And I'm able to take things back and forth between them. So
absolutely.
So as I say, it's probably a good topic for a future show.
Well, some of the other things about decorators, right? I said code reuse, I said registration. The other two things are annotation and semantic changes. Mm-hmm. And by annotation, I mean the kind of thing I do in snake juice. I've seen it done in other places where it doesn't actually change the behavior of anything, just adds metadata on to the class or the method.
Okay.
And I can't think of a good example now, but I've seen that in the past where you pass in the function, right, how decorator works, and then just tack something onto the function, so a new attribute or whatever, so you can pick it up later.
Cherry Pie does that with their exposed decorator.
Yeah. So I don't find that necessarily bad, because it really doesn't change behavior. And because you're expecting that annotation to be, or the data to be annotated there, probably okay. Mm-hmm. Still, it could be lead to bad things. And the other, the semantic changes is more like what standard Python has with class method and static method, where it changes the meaning of the method, right?
Okay.
So that instead of being a normal instance method, you get the class, or you don't get the class passed in.
Right.
And
class
I think those things are
static
okay.
Static method are kind of, those are almost like fundamental pieces of the language at this point.
And I think they're okay, because they, what they allow you to do is change something without having new syntax. So you don't need a static keyword, you don't need a class method type keyword. And the way they change it probably doesn't limit the reuse, because that's the way you would have it anyways. If you had a static keyword, that function would be static. Too bad. And I don't think that that really introduces any problems with the semantic changes. I mean, the big thing that I don't like is the code reuse. And the fact that, like, if you go back to, like, the patterns craze of the 90s, where they said favor composition over inheritance, and
mm-hmm.
what they're really talking about is favor dynamic assembly over static construction.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like static, or the dynamic assembly, because like just like WSGI middleware, I could reassemble that in different apps in different ways and come up with a completely new app based on the same exact code.
Legos. Exactly.
Legos are great.
Yes. Legos are awesome.
So I mean, that's my piece.
So, I mean, would you have, for new folks, because we do want to bring it back down so that new folks can enjoy this
mm-hmm.
podcast, what do you have any recommendations for them? Maybe not so much guidelines, but you know, ways to approach decorators, ways to ways that you would recommend them using them. Or
I don't even know if I have ways that I recommend myself using them.
This is a funny point, because
I don't actually use them.
Right, and this is I was completely unfamiliar with Python decorators before I started working with you guys, and once I began seeing them, I'm kind of like, but why would I do that? Why would I not just, you know, wrap it in a different way, or pass something in that does what I want it to do? Or
I mean, I naturally gravitate towards the other solutions that I talked about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm composing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason right now that I use decorators is one, snake use. I had no other way.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nice clean syntax to add metadata.
Mm-hmm.
And then anytime I use a framework that says use this decorator here, or use this decorator,
mm-hmm.
I use the decorator the framework suggests.
Now, from a pragmatic point of view, though, they are really useful for some scripting tasks. Depending on if you're using Python to do system administration, that ability to extend the behavior of functions without extending the amount of code in the function is a very practical use.
But decorator is not the only way to do that.
True.
So I've never actually I don't actually use decorators myself.
Right.
I don't know that it's a preference.
Oh, so you're like those guys that ban books but never actually read them.
Right. Exactly.
Right. It's just filth. Filth, I say.
I see the problems that you guys have with decorators, and I hear all the complaints from people that say, "Well, why can't I do this?" And
totally lost,
like,
credibility with our listeners, dude.
You used a decorator. Too bad.
Yeah.
I can't help you.
Yeah.
You fit.
But as a newbie, you probably just shouldn't use decorators.
You
at
know,
all.
Honestly, I would think that it's kind of like needing to know the rules before you break the rules.
Right.
I'm not saying that decorators break the rules in any way, but, you know, it's... I liken this to when you're learning... When you're in English class and learning the structure of sentences and learning, you know, meters of poetry and that kind of thing. Yeah, there are people who can write in free verse, but they do it in such a way because they know the rules and they can make it good because they're using the rules to break the rules. You know, if you're new to it, you're just going to come up with very bad code, and you know, please don't go there.
Well, and here where we tend to have a lot of non-Python people, just Ohio apparently isn't the center of Python developers, but you see a lot of new people to the language come in and, you know, read a book, and all of a sudden they see decorators and they see,
mm-hmm.
you know, context managers and descriptors, and you get a lot of, like, exceedingly clever code beyond what the person is actually capable of at
mm-hmm.
that point in time.
Right. It can be a little deceiving, and you can get a... You begin to fool yourself into thinking that you're better than you actually are, which has been the downfall of many a programmer, myself included.
Yeah.
So I like to rephrase what I said before. I don't not use any decorators. So I use class method and static method all the time. I
okay.
just don't make up my own a whole lot.
All right.
I don't find any use for it.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
Yeah.
All right, then. Well, I think that'll do it for at least this this segment. We'll be back in a little bit when we talk to a compatriot of ours who had some interesting points on our Zen of Python.
Well, did you want to talk about the packaging thing?
Do you want to do that in this episode?
Let's go for it. I mean, it's only been 15 minutes or so.
Oh, yeah. All right. Okay.
So you want to
forget I said
start?
Anything.
Sure. So anyone who follows the, what is it, the Python ideas list?
Yeah, pretty sure.
Ian Bicking made a post just recently. I think it was last Friday or something like that. That kind of is a discussion of the standard library and the development of the standard library, and maybe even taking the development of the standard library out of the development of Python to kind of separate the two tracks of development. And it's kind of grown into a very long thread. The gist of it is that Ian is concerned that by putting some of his projects into the standard library, specifically pip, that the development is now dead. Adding new features is really slow, and fixing bugs takes a while, and you have to rely on people to upgrade their standard library or their entire distribution of Python to get the new features for that that app. So that's a little bit of background on the topic. What do you think, Dave?
I completely agree with that. That a lot of, especially things that aren't currently in the standard library, I don't like adding more stuff into it.
Why, though? Because that's kind of the thing that makes Python so awesome. If you get onto a new machine at a new company and all they have is Python installed, you can feel pretty good that you're going to have everything you need to do almost anything you need
including
to do.
Including your dead batteries. Batteries included doesn't necessarily mean they're new batteries and fresh batteries. So I really like the way, like, Linux does the distribution where you download Ubuntu 9.10 and you get these versions of the packages, but as time goes on and as upstream makes fixes and does whatever, you can get the newer version of the package. Mm-hmm. Like, we have this problem all the time here where, okay, well, they made a bug fix, or they made this new feature in this prior or this future version of Python that we don't have yet, and we go copy down the file and have to put in a weird location so it's in the import path, and why should we have to do that? Why don't I have a nice way to distribute that stuff outside of the standard distribution mechanism?
Well, I don't think Ian's argument, though, was exclusive to the standard library. I don't think he was saying, like, halt all work on distutils 2. We don't need to do packaging if we just separate the standard library out.
Right.
I think he was more concerned just about getting his stuff going quickly.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. So, I mean, I don't know where I read it. It was somewhere on Python Ideas or Python Dev or something where basically, packages go to the standard library to die.
I disagree with that.
I've heard that comment made too, but shouldn't the standard libraries be stable? I mean, isn't that the whole point of the standard library is stability? And you know, if stability is the goal, then you can't be constantly changing things, and you can't be constantly upgrading things.
I don't have a problem right now with the 30,000 things outside of the standard library that I have to use.
Yeah.
Right. Every time I start an app up, I automatically have to download web app and routes if I'm doing a web app, or you know, simple JSON or a bunch of other stuff, all outside of the Python standard library, right? And I don't have a problem with, okay, well, every so often I'll make sure that I'm on the latest version, everything works in the latest versions, and oh, you know, they just released this new awesome feature that I can take advantage of. I can go update to that version. And the standard library, I'd wait for a new point release. And I think that would take a long time.
Well, you would have to wait for that, but on the opposite side of it, there's a lot of, like, imagine that you just want to write a simple command line app and you don't have a logging framework.
No, I'm not saying that it shouldn't come with anything. So I'm not saying Python comes with no libs. What I'm saying is that, just like Ubuntu, I would love to see it come with some version caught at some point in time and then have an easy path to upgrade those things outside of standard Python.
Well, the argument that people are making, and I don't remember who said it, you'd have to go read the thread, but is that instead of now, well, I depend on Python 2.7.1, or even just generically 2.7, I depend on Python 2.7 and standard library 1.4.3 and setup tools 2. And
who cares? You already have that problem. I need web app 0.9.8. I need routes 1.0. I need Django 1.2. I mean, that's what pip helps you with, right? With the whole freeze idea. I mean, you're always going to have that problem. Why dodge it and pretend that we don't have it?
Well, so the other argument that I personally have against it is the crotchety sysadmin argument. I've worked in shops with exceedingly crotchety sysadmins that absolutely refused to install anything except what came with the OS. So you would get Perl, you would get Python, and you would get
Bash.
Does
that include other eggs that you would need to write an app?
Yeah, none of that. That was completely not allowed.
You can't do that much useful stuff with it anyways. I say get a new job.
And I did. That's why I work here. But
I mean, I don't think you could use that as an example of any kind of good behavior.
But I think that the crotchety sysadmin problem is actually not all that uncommon. I mean, I may have been in kind of an extreme case of that, but I think other people out there probably have to deal with that same issue.
I mean, I don't know how to even respond to that. This is stupid. So that means that anytime you wanna build an app, you have two options. You have copy down the code from external package and put it inside of your development tree and pretend
right.
it's yours, which is stupid, or reinvent the wheel and do it all yourself and spend the next 6 months doing something that someone else spent 10 years perfecting,
is
stupid.
Luckily, though, because there were enough batteries in the standard library, I was able to cope with not... I didn't need anything else. I was able
to
assemble
things. Depends on the app, though. If you're building a web app, there's not enough batteries. I mean, you can build one from standard library, but it's going to take you a long time. You're going to basically rebuild a framework when you have Django and TurboGears and 10 million other frameworks.
And that's kind of an interesting point, too. I mean, what is the standard library? Like, what is the cutoff for that?
I mean, if it is truly a bunch of, like, really low-level, simplified things without not a lot of, like, application work in it, like something like utilities for dictionaries and logging framework and stuff that's really done. Like, logging framework is pretty much done. You know, besides bug fixes, I don't know what you'd add to it. But something like pip or snake juice or Django or any of those things that are evolving and building on top of prior work, you don't want to have that there. You want them to evolve.
I would tend to agree with that. Pip, I don't know, though. Pip is... I would kind of divide the Python community up, or the Python packages up in a way, and one of those would be infrastructure packages. Infrastructure packages being logging systems and distutils and distutils 2 and setup tools. And I think pip falls solidly into that category of infrastructure packages. And realistically, those should not change very much. You know, once Tarek gets finished with all of his work on distutils 2, I would imagine that's going to probably be pretty stable and should be.
And then until we need a distutils 3. And then we'll do the same thing again. It'll be developed outside the standard library until it's ready.
And ultimately be included in. And
so we're actually doing what I suggest now. We're just doing it in a weird way.
I don't know that it's weird, though, so much as it's the appropriate way of developing. Do your really rapid development somewhere else, but ultimately realize that it should be integrated back in and become a long-running, stable,
package. Like, and I think I said this, but maybe not as nicely on the list, it wasn't as clear on the list, but like for distutils 2, that's fine. You're developing it outside, the actual tree is on Bitbucket somewhere, you're doing your job. Mm-hmm. Eventually it becomes stable and we want to put in Python 2.7 or 5.9 or, you know, 10.1. You cut it and you stabilize it and you do bug fixes there. This is the whole cool thing about distributed version control. But the actual distutils 2, 3, 4, 5, 12, whatever, keeps going forward. And eventually, at some point in time, Python looks back and they're on 10.1 and this version of distutils 2. They're going to release 10.2 and we say, okay, well, let's take this version now because that's stable. It's reasonably stable. It's been out for a year, 2 years. Cut it there and bring it in, stabilize it. And then have the key, though, to me is have a way outside of standard Python or, you know, a place where I can put it and download the newest version. Because as a developer, I want to have the newest version of stuff because I want those extra features.
Right. I think that lets you be on the cutting edge while me dealing with a crotchety sysadmin who won't upgrade any code on the box can still kind of have enough features to get my job done without
too much. That's right, but I mean that's what I think should happen is that things really should be done outside when possible, especially for these big apps. Because like standard library right now is a lot of smaller things you compose into an app.
Right.
Right. As you start adding more bigger things into it, we have to start stepping back and thinking, okay, well, is this something that is truly done, or is there a lot of evolution left in its future?
I think there's if you followed any of the arg parse discussions, I think some of the techniques they use there are generally applicable to other packages. You know, how stable is it? How actively developed is it? Is it feature complete? Like, are we going to put something that's halfway in the standard library? I think you've got to kind of apply that to any package that's a candidate for inclusion, as well as how broadly useful is it? Django is not really broadly useful to everybody. Not because it's not useful, but because only a chunk of the community actually does web development.
Right, I just bring that up because it's a big package.
Right.
But same goes for any of the big packages in PyPy. There's tons of stuff. Which ones? I mean, there's some things that everybody I know uses. Right? I mean, almost everybody I ever talk to uses mock to do mocking.
Should that
be included in the standard library?
I would say that's probably a good candidate for inclusion.
I don't think so.
I think it's very much complementary to the unit test framework. If we're going to have a unit test framework,
really like,
why wouldn't we have a good, stable mocking library?
You know, what difference does it make? I mean, to me, I can easily install it. I don't care. Done.
You can, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't want to limit the awesomeness that could be because there's certain people that can't handle it, like crotchety cissid bins.
Yeah, I just think you have to kind of account for that in some way with your language. I mean, and there's varying degrees of crotchety sysadmin. I was at the extreme end of that.
I mean, you could argue that if you can't install any package besides just what's in Python, you're already dead before you start.
No, Python is a remarkably useful language given all the batteries you have.
Yeah, but it takes you for... I mean, you're going to have to rebuild everything. I mean, no one wants to do that. Someone already did a really great job over here doing this library. Why do I have to reinvent that?
And admittedly, at the time, I didn't know about VirtualEnv. In fact, I don't even know if VirtualEnv was around 3 years ago when I had this problem. But you could solve it with VirtualEnv and just ship a virtual environment.
I mean, we had that problem here for a while, where it was really hard to get packages updated, and our workaround was stupid, but we have an opt package, which you know very well, that we took standard stuff, not standard, we took stuff out of PyPy that we knew and was stable, we put it down in this opt package that we distributed with our app, and went and usually had to hack some things in those third-party packages to make sure it imported correctly, and yeah, that's what we did.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to get around it. It's just that I would advocate generally what's in the standard library should kind of stay, and anything that's broadly useful should probably.
What you're
be
saying
added.
Is exactly what I said with the Ubuntu, Linux type comment. You get a distribution that's fully functional with stable versions of stuff, and then you can choose to update individual subsystems, packages, whatever you want to call them.
So I was thinking a little bit about this yesterday, and one of the things that could be nice is to have an alternate set of packages for Python. So today, Python is packaged as the Python interpreter plus standard library. I would say that should probably stay forever, but also have the option to package the Python interpreter separately and the standard library separately. So if you're in the scenario where you want to have various a new version of the standard library, upgrade them independently, there's kind of an officially packaged path that gets you there. But still preserving that ability to have the all-in-one, batteries-included version of Python for general use.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I'm still right in line with what I was saying.
Yeah.
There's a default that comes with whatever the default set of libraries are, and then there's a way to upgrade parts of it. That's all I want.
You're still going to be, most people are still going to be aimed at the lowest common denominator anyhow, though. So.
Oh, that's not true, because every time I download a new patch from PyPy, I got to upgrade a whole host of other crap. So maybe within the standard library people are doing that, but outside of that, people are depending on the brand new version of whatever was just released in their code. So you go download this package, it says, oh, you're using... You know, you get an attribute error, and you're like, oh, shit, why? And so, oh, I'm on version 0.9 of something, not 0. Or not the 1.0, or whatever it may be.
And some developers are better about well, I don't know that better is the right word, but some developers care more about backwards compatibility than others, too. So.
Oh, that's the truth.
But I think the general conclusion from my perspective is I really don't mind the standard library being developed in Python. I think for the people who do care about it, there should be an alternate official distribution of Python that lets you install the two independently. But I'm pretty comfortable with it all being one big distribution.
Why not just have an upgrade channel? Download the standard version from python.org and have an upgrade channel so I can upgrade if I wanted to.
Right, which having
not
having
the Python interpreter, but upgrade the libraries if I wanted to.
Having an official package route of it being split would accomplish exactly that.
Yep. That's all I want.
And it lets downstream packagers deal with it nicely too.
All I want is simple. It's not hard. I mean, I actually forked the standard library. I have a private Mercurial repository with the standard library imported. No history, just what it was when I got it. And I started, like, jiggering things around. You know, like, the naming conventions are whack, so everything's lowercase. And I started normalizing stuff just so that I could, you know, give people replacement batteries if they wanted it. But there's no really good way to do that. You have to monkey patch your path and
well, you could ball it all up as a zip file and stick that at the top of your syspath.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the thing that's painful is everybody has to do that in their app.
True.
Everywhere. It's not just like if you're on my Python box, this one is set up automatically for that, and I'd have to go and I have to do magic. It's non-standard magic.
And all of the stuff that's written for the Dave standard library is non-portable.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah, what are you going to do? And it's just like depending on a third-party package. You have to get the third-party package or you use it.
Well, on that note, let's take a little break. We'll be back in a sec. With us, joining us now, is Mike Piernot, one of our compatriots here. He's also the fellow that did the artwork for our wonderful logo. He's given us a lot of advice on sound quality, which we've ignored. And but he had some interesting feedback on the ZenoPython that we wanted to get to, that he wrote a blog post about. So we wanted to sit down and discuss it with him.
Yeah, so I filed these guys a comment the other day, and I realized, hey, that comment's actually long enough to be a post, so I just copied and pasted it and trimmed it up. It was a nice excuse to get back to blogging. So anyway, so I really enjoyed the two-parter on the ZenoPython, but I've been thinking that you guys may have missed something really interesting in the last item in the Zen, which is, you know, in that namespaces are one honking great idea, let's do more of those. And I really didn't have this light bulb moment until I was listening to the podcast a couple weeks ago and thought, well, but there's so much more here than what you're talking about. So for a long time, I really overlooked it myself. On its face, it seems sort of a little bit frivolous, maybe too specific. You know, up until that point, the Zen is all about these sort of broad strokes and really elegant generalizations, you know, sort of a code to live by. And suddenly, out of nowhere, bam, here comes this thing that's about namespaces. It's honking and colloquialisms and exclamation points everywhere. It feels really sort of tacked on and strange, and it doesn't really bookend beautiful is better than ugly very well to
me. You have to be Dutch to get it.
Yeah, maybe. And sort of like this gangly teenager trying to fit in with this sort of more mature, hip crowd. And so, you know, the conversation in the podcast went down the nerd rabbit hole to talk about what a namespaces mean, and namespaces in Python, and namespaces in Java, and namespaces in PHP, and things. And it really kind of neglects what I think is the real meat, which is a pity, because this might actually be one of the most important aspects of the Zen if you think about it a little longer. I really think this is an expression of the enthusiasm and joy that pervade the Python community. This is Python's get excited and make things. It's a formal declaration that it's all right for us to get really excited and turned on by the stuff that we make. It's almost a mission statement to go forth and create new things that are delightful, that are going to be a delight for you and for your users and for everybody who encounters them. And that those people who encounter the things that you make can be similarly inspired to get out and make their own things that make the world a better place and that turn people on and make us all happy. And it's really a reminder above all that Python should be fun. And if you're not having fun, you're probably doing something wrong. So think about all that next time you're crafting some Python code and see if that changes your perspective on
how did
things.
You connect those dots, though?
I don't know.
You know, honestly,
that sounds like a new entry for the Zen list.
In a way, I was trying. Well, I've been trying to understand it for a long time, and when I, you know, I ran off a sort of a nicely formatted, nice topography version of the Zen of Python a couple of years ago to post around the office, and I actually left this one off of it because it really didn't seem to fit in. I was having a hard time getting text to be readable with that much stuff on a page, and well, you know, this can go. It's sort of this weird thing. It's got exclamation points, and it's about namespaces, and who says honking, really? At least nobody that I know, at least not currently, is really into that. So I've been subconsciously trying to process this for years, that this the Zen is such a great and wise thing that I really take a lot of inspiration from and really means a lot to me, and then there's this thing at the end that I just didn't get. Like, what the hell is it doing there? And like I said, it was like this light bulb moment while I was listening to the podcast a couple weeks ago that, you know, everybody focused in on that very first word about namespaces and not about what the other things are that are in there. Great ideas, do more, exclamation point.
So maybe we could just sub namespaces with Python.
Sure.
You know, I honestly really liked reading this when you put this out, because we did get caught up in the semantics of the words that were there. Ben, I think you're exactly right, because it doesn't have that weird ethereal feel of the rest of it. It's almost like that last line needs to be in quotes.
Right.
You know, it needs to be something that someone is shouting, as opposed to something that goes with the rest of the I don't know what's the right word for it, the Zen. So
I just assumed it was tacked on because of the standard library's lack of clarity in namespaces.
I never thought about it like that, because it's always seemed weird to me too that why would you? Okay, you've kind of been real high level and real really not Python specific, and all of a sudden, boom, you throw in there a very concrete example: namespaces. Why? Mm-hmm. But
namespaces.
No, but it's very concrete when you consider that, consider the rest of the
Right, beautiful is better than ugly. That's pretty, pretty value judgment.
Right.
That's pretty general. I mean, so, no, I wanted to thank you for putting that in. I think that's a welcome addition to this.
Yeah.
And
thank you very much.
So I think I would like to hear what other people think about this as well, because I had not considered it from the figurative. Maybe that's a better, I don't know. It's not figurative. It's
more sort of abstract or metaphorical or
right.
something.
Right, right.
It's an enigma wrapped in a mystery.
Wrapped in bacon.
Delicious bacon.
Yes. So.
Just to tack one last thing on here,
sure.
too. Guido just tweeted a post by Barry Warsaw, I believe,
mm-hmm.
That actually kind of just digging back into the history of Python a little bit. Barry talks where the Zen came from and how import this happened,
mm-hmm.
and links off to a mailing list thread from 1999,
which is hysterical. I also noticed that he calls out the goat.
He
calls out the goat. So
it's worth a read, though.
It is.
Well, it's a Wikipedia style rabbit hole, though, because I ended up going down and reading that post from 99 and then searching through the archives, and it's dangerous to do that, but it's a well written, interesting thought.
Definitely.
I shed a little tear for the
the
cheese shop when I read that. It was one of the comments about the renaming of cheese shop to Pi Pi.
Mm-hmm. That
made me
sad. That made me sad. I liked the cheese shop.
I like that Python has been a place that is fun and has been about having a sense of humor. That's,
you know, and that
there's something kind of cool, inherently cool about a language or a tool that you're working with that inherently has a sense of humor about it.
You know, and I think that would be an interesting, again, we've gotten two interesting topics for future shows out of this episode, but, you know, Python's sense of humor, are we in danger of losing that? Are we becoming too formal? Are we becoming too...
Enterprise.
Too enterprise capable.
If you think that, like, PyPy was renamed, it was renamed to PyPy for the suits, any
Who
more...
Who are the suits in Python?
Well, the suits that are reading Fortune magazine.
People.
And, yeah. But the programmers now seem to kind of be driving Programmers in general at companies across the world seem to kind of be pushing for things like Python. So we should just lighten up and, you know, keep the whole cheese shop and the Monty Python jokes and realize that programmers are starting to push this stuff anyhow. So we don't need a lot of J.star acronyms for Python.
Does this mean I can submit my thesaurus object to the standard library?
Only if it's ready to die.
All right. Oh, there we go. Looping right back.
That's great. All right. Were here when I said that.
I think we'll put a bow on this particular episode. Thank you for joining us. I do want to note that the next couple of weeks are going to be a little bit crazy, so I don't know when the next show is going to be recorded. This is mostly because I'm the guy with the recording equipment. However, if we can get one in, I doubt that one will drop on the first of the month. Probably the week after that, after the United States Independence Day week, somewhere in there, we'll get one dropped.
And when the dust settles, we'll try and get back around to our normal 1:15 schedule.
No, we will get back to that. It's just, I apologize. It's completely my fault. I'm moving. So
in the meantime, while Chris is moving, if anyone's interest in being a guest speaker on the podcast, drop us a comment. Let us know. We're interested in having some people join us.
Absolutely. And if you've got audio capability, feel free to record something to us and email it. On that note, bye.
Bye-bye.
This job fulfilling in creative way, such a load of crap. Code Monkey thinks someday he...
This podcast has been released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives Works 3.0 Unported License. The theme song for this podcast is Code Monkey by Jonathan Colton. Learn more about him at jonathancolton.com. Big, warm, fuzzy, secret heart. To learn more about us or to catch up on past shows, please visit us at frompythonimportpodcast.com. Monkey like you.